The orphan and the serial killer sat at the kitchen table, side by side. Jessica, meanwhile, in closed casket Jack. Allies who grew to become unlikely friends. Before them lay a pile of documents, maps, tapes, and a tablet queued up with a few select video clips. "You doing okay, Jess?" Jack asked through a mouthful of Ben and Jerry's half-baked. "I mean, with all these changes, and Lila, and the epiphany thing..." Jessica shoveled in a huge scoop of the Tonight Dough with Jimmy Fallon, just to give herself a few seconds to ponder her response. "I'm hanging in there, but it's a little lonely." He nodded, then reached over and swapped his carton for hers. They looked sideways at each other as they took the next bite. "So what do you think?" she prodded. "Half-baked, no question. They're kind of the same, but Fallon has peanut butter in it." "And you don't like peanut butter?" "Meh." "Who doesn't like peanut butter?" "Me, I guess. I also like sour milk, so..." She took another bite. "I'm going Fallon 10 times out of 10. This is mind-blowing." So they switched back their cartons and kept eating. "Jack, you said you had something to tell me." "Mm-hmm." "Not something. Everything. The big picture. We have held so much back from you because we saw you as a kid. But you're no kid, not anymore. Besides, if everything goes pear-shaped, we need someone to tell the tale. Jess, you know about the end of days." "Mm-hmm." "And the emissaries, the brain slugs." "Mm-hmm." "The ghastly ones." "Mm-hmm." "But you don't know what they are. I do. This won't make things any easier, but hopefully it will make some kind of sense." He took another bite of ice cream. "The devil is dead. And what came after was so much worse." Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters, and mayhem. Killers, cannibals, and cults. Fearful fiction and furious fact. Tall tales and terrifying truths. This is A Scary Home Companion.
Over the course of my research, I discovered this letter. A piece of personal correspondence from H.P. Lovecraft to his pen pal, Harry Houdini. Dated 1926, courtesy the Lovecraft Foundation. "Harry, your mind is as sharp as ever. Indeed, the island that houses Dread Cthulhu was based on the dream you shared with me some time ago. Upon its publication, I have received several missives over its contents. And while most of them are either blather or pomp, one has proven quite fruitful. It is from a young scholar who claims he has collected several written accounts of others seeing this foul, wretched island. Not stories, Harry, but personal accounts. This mysterious island from your dream exists in reality. Somewhere between Florida and Cuba, from what I can discern. The local islanders call it the End of Days." Acting on one of our older discussions, I asked this scholar what he knew about the Ophidian, but have yet to receive a written response. I will be certain to share these papers with you upon your next visit. Your friend, HPL.
I don't know who H.P. Lovelace is, Jessica said, or Harry Houdini. They were important men. They saw more than they were supposed to. What about the Ophidian? What do you know about that? Well, after Epiphany, I read everything I could about the Ophidian. Snake God appears in 100 different cultures and religions. The snake in the Garden of Eden, for example, or the monster Leviathan in Revelations, the Hydra, the Dragon, Quetzalcoatl, Jormung, you know, Loki's kid. Jack shook his head. Well, I guess I know more than you do. I guess so. And a story has to start at the beginning. The Ophidian is the beginning. It was the original evil. The resident evil, you could say. I love that game. He rolled his eyes. You know, I didn't want to say the phrase Resident Evil because I knew you would say that. Resident Evil doesn't mean zombies. It means... What it means, she cut in, is the evil connected to a place. The evil connected to the world. It's the baseline. Just like good always exists, so does this. Resident Evil doesn't go away. It can't. I think the Ophidian was here a long time before humans were, Jack said. Not here with us, but right next to us on the other side of the veil. And the only way it could get through was in our dreams. When we dream, we enter this place that isn't here or there. We exist, and so does it. Okay, Yoda. Yoda? Why Yoda? You say you're going to have this big important thing to tell me, then you tell me a bunch of stuff that I already know. Bear with me. It's important. I know, but I'm almost out of Fallon. Also, you said the other side of the veil. What does that mean, like, exactly? Jack pulled up a video and pressed play.
The concept of pocket dimension stems from theoretical physics and inflationary theory. It's also called a pocket universe, or an alternate dimension. It posits there are many dimensions or universes, perhaps an infinite number. They exist next to, concurrent with, and overlapping one another as a result of the initial expansion after the Big Bang. Think of it as a patchwork quilt, and each patch operates under its own rules, its own reality. There are no limitations in terms of size or power, so don't let the word pocket fool you. Where these dimensions touch or overlap, there can be connection points. These ideas are far more useful in fiction than in science. Narnia is a great example, or the hell mouth from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There is a bridge or a breach that links the two pockets, and theoretically, it's possible to move between them. Theoretically. A colleague of mine is fascinated with this topic. He even showed me some footage from Las Vegas where it was possible to see into another dimension. I will admit, the special effects were good, but I don't think it was science.
Hell is real, Jack said. It's not make-believe, it exists, sitting right next to us, on the other side of the veil. Whenever you say veil, I think about the crying lady, the long black veil. Jack nodded and looked away. Has anyone ever told you about my sister Becky? Well, I know she was your twin and she went missing. I know that they got her. And I'm sorry for that. He shrugged away her sympathy. It was worse than that. A man named Nick Braithwaite took her. There was this ghastly sorority, and anyway, Becky was taken to the island as a tribute to the ghastly ones. They always need fresh meat to play with. Over there, the rules are different. Time doesn't work the same. Life and death don't exist. So they tortured her. They took her apart and put her back together over and over again, just to feed on the pain. And then something happened to me. The mirror man lured me in. He got close. I was in a coma for a while, and the whole time my mind was trapped over there, on the end of days. And they made me watch. They made me watch as they dismantled Becky and made her shriek just to torment me. They couldn't touch me, so they took it out on her. Not for revenge, just for fun. So they could feed on me the best way they could. I watched Becky die and come back screaming 100 times. Until there was nothing left of either one of us. And then they showed me things. They told me truths nobody could handle. They exposed their true selves to me because they knew that it would break me. And it did. Just not in the way they wanted. Then they made Becky one of them. They took her under the island to the pool. They threw her in it, and she came out ghastly, filled with evil. The nightmare people don't make you into something you aren't. They play with what they have to work with. And with Becky, it was suffering. So they made her keep suffering. They turned her into the long black veil, and they used her to torment me, to try and lure me back in, to bring me to the island to save her. "Isn't that exactly what you're going to do?" Jessica asked. "Yes and no. I know there's no saving Becky. She's too far gone. But maybe I can destroy her. I can erase her along with all the other nightmare people. Maybe that will bring her peace, set her free. Or maybe it'll just stop her from being a puppet for these things. I'll take what I can get." Jessica grabbed Jack's hand and gave it a squeeze. "I'm telling you this to scare you," he said. "You need to stay as far away from this as possible. Because there are worse things than dying, Jess." She nodded. "Okay, I understand." "No, not yet you don't. See, the island doesn't have humans. Everyone there came from here, from our pocket. They recruit some people who come voluntarily, but others are just victims taken to the next level. The thing is that whenever they cross over here, or whenever one of us goes over there, changes happen. I'm saying it wrong. Here, listen to this, and you'll recognize this one."
Whenever two unique ecosystems come into contact with one another, each of them changes. They both influence new developments on the other side. Sometimes it's a little, sometimes it's a lot. But the changes are real. They spur mutation, drive evolution. This is not a theory. This is a fact proven countless times over. It is also my personal theory on profane botany. I know it's difficult for many of you to believe this, but you have seen the evidence I've presented, the samples, the references. Profane botany is simply the result of two unique ecosystems meeting, however briefly. In this case, one of those ecosystems is not from here. It's not terrestrial. If you believe the folklore, then we have been touched by hell, and it has impacted our environment. I have documented what it has done to our flora and fauna. What I don't know is how it impacts the other side.
Was that Harriet? Our Harriet? Crazy Harriet Ford? Jack nodded. Gosh, she sounded so normal back then. Do you understand what she was saying? Sure, I think. The ghastly ones influence us and our behavior, but we influence them too, right? That's right. Not in the ways you would expect, though. Profane botany is just one example. Whenever a breach gets opened, there's that cross-contamination she was talking about. It makes these profane plants grow on both sides, not just here. Those drawings I just showed you of the Oregon orchards, they weren't always on the end of days. That new life, that profane life, started growing there because of interaction with our world. Don't they, like, farm it or something? Yes, they do. That's the point I'm going for here, Jessica. They are mutating and evolving thanks to their interactions with us, with humans. They cultivate profane plants to make new life out of dead flesh. They want to keep evolving. They want to revitalize the island to what it once was. What Harriet was saying about ecosystems, it's not just plants and animals. It's also dreams and thoughts and reality. They all change each other. The ghastly ones learn from us, from our dreams, and they incorporate all of that into themselves, into who they are. It makes them apex predators on a whole new level. And when one of them dies, which doesn't happen often, but it does happen, another one takes its place. Sometimes it looks exactly as the last one. Sometimes it's entirely new. They build these things on the island. They build nightmares and nightmare people. This is also part of their evolution. Jessica murmured. Demons can evolve. How about that? It's easy to call them demons because that's what they look like. That's what all of this looks like by design. They have spent all of human history posing as gods and devils, slipping between the cracks into cultures and religions. And as culture changes, so do they. But they aren't demons. Not the kind from the Bible or from horror movies. They're something else. They're a life form evolved into something that it's hard to wrap your head around. Jack, I'm ready. Lay it on me. Living thoughts. Come again. We call them the nightmare people because that is exactly what they are. Nightmares made flesh. And in our world, once they cross through a breach, they can never stay for long. Because the rules are different here. Jessica nodded, Every pocket has its own reality. So help me understand this. You say that our dreams influence these things, but that they come from somewhere else. That's right. So if they can't come here, they can still come into our dreams? He nodded. The dreamscape is in between the two places, freely accessed from both sides, here and hell. But not Bible hell. No, but it probably is what inspired Bible hell. Okay, so forgive me if this is a stupid question. So if the nightmare people don't come from our dreams, they feed on them, where do they come from? Someone else's dreams in another pocket? He patted her shoulder and stood up. I have something to show you that is going to help. Do you want fish food or chunky monkey?
Before I wrap up, I have one last thing. It's not in my notes, forgive me, because I wasn't sure I would discuss it. But as many of you already know, I am in the terminal stage. Tonight you have been present for my final public address. With that in mind, I'd like to share something I've never shared with anyone before. There was a non-disclosure agreement, you see, and a healthy sum of money exchanged. I suppose none of that matters now. The DRO will not be pleased about this, but I only have 3 months at best, so what's the worst they can do? Many, many years ago, I was called to meet with an agent from the DRO. He called himself Jonestown. Damnedest thing, that. As a psychologist and a psychiatrist with deep knowledge of the human mind, Jonestown asked me for my professional opinion on something they could not identify. He presented me with something that made my skin crawl. It was a slug in a glass jar. Big and fat, perhaps a kilo in weight, the most repulsive shade of green I've ever seen. I held the jaw and examined the creature. It was very much alive and active, oozing around in there. Besides its coloration, a curious blend of inky black and sparkling emerald green, it had no discernible features. Yet I noticed a curious vibration through the glass itself. Almost electric, yet not quite. I asked the agent for more information, and he said they had none. Other than it was most likely non-terrestrial in origin, in a single-celled organism. I set the jar down and said, "Sir, I believe what you have here is a neuron."
Jessica blinked rapidly. As it started to sink in, she became short of breath. She put her spoon down, no longer hungry for Chunky Monkey. She whispered, "So, the emissaries aren't brain slugs. They're brain cells." Jack said, "The end of days isn't made of rock. It's made of bone. That tall, jagged spire, it's a horn. This isn't an island, Jessica. It's a skull. Turned sideways and so submerged in the water and muck that we can only see a tiny piece of it. And deep inside, under the island, is where the emissaries live. Trapped in the sludge of that rotting brain pan locked into corpse's shell until they can wriggle their way into a vessel to carry them out. There are other islands around it, other parts of the corpse floating on the surface, extending out from this place, the core, the center of it all. But you said they can't come here to our pocket because of the rules. The slugs hide inside of us for two reasons, Jessica. They can interface with our subconscious in ways they can't do with any other life forms. We are unique, and the bond they form with us is almost unbreakable. They control the body when awake, and they connect with the others as the host sleeps. The dreamscape is still very much the glue that binds both sides together. They also, to your point, use our bodies as suits of armor to protect them from the ambient radiation. The ghastly ones and the emissaries are very, very different. They work together, symbiotic, but they are two different forms of life. The ghastlies are the spirit, and the emissaries are the mind. And no matter how far apart these brain cells get, even across worlds, they are still one mind. Mona called it a neural network, and it's one that keeps getting bigger. It's one giant brain which keeps evolving. And the more it grows, the smarter it gets. It's a gestalt, Jessica said. I read about that. More than the sum of its parts. Matthias says, there are three aspects to life, said Jack. The body, the mind, and the soul. In this case, the body has been dead for a long time. But the mind and the spirit keep evolving and mutating. They keep clinging to life, and they use us to do it. She found the courage to switch cartons and take a big bite of fish food. Okay, so the body is dead, but its thoughts and its brain cells are still alive. Okay. So what is it the body of? The Ophidian. As I said earlier, the Ophidian is the beginning. I've seen its corpse in the black water, Jessica. I've seen it. The Ophidian isn't a giant snake. It's not a hydra or a dragon. It's something else. So alien? So vast in size it tortures your sanity trying to understand it. When it was alive, it looked like a rose bush crossed with a DNA strand, twisted and gnarled, and all the stems and stalks constantly writhing. And there weren't flowers, just 100 tiny sightless heads ripping chunks from itself, tearing away pieces from everything that it touched, every world that it crossed. And it all grew from this place, from this skull. Now it's still. It's dead. All that remains is the end of days. This skull, this brain, and the living nightmares that live on it. We can finish it off.
I once met a man named Hume. He was a cardinal in the Catholic Church, and yet he retained an open mind, which is very rare in that line of work. After one of my lectures, we sat down to discuss philosophy, religion, and, of course, dreams. Colonel Hume was an avid reader of my papers. He wanted to pick my brain, so to speak. He told me of his personal theory as well. After the War of the Rebel Angels, Lucifer was disfigured, broken, and then cast out of heaven to be a monster and a devil. As he plummeted to hell, he managed to reach out and grab a little piece of our world. Yes, is that famous breach in the Devil's Triangle, the same one my brother was trying to find when he vanished. Hume believed it was caused by Lucifer's fall. In response, I said to the cardinal, well, what if I were to say to you that I believe it was not the devil, but an ancient entity from another plane of existence that caused the breach? This is not my theory, of course. I was trying to make light of his beliefs. He patted my hand like a father would. He kindly said to me, We are both students of the unimaginable, you and I. Perhaps we believe the same thing and just use different words to say it. He would later die for his beliefs. I can still hear his voice so clearly.
Jack said, "Now that we're approaching the endgame, Jessica, I felt it was so important for you to know all of this. So you had a bigger picture of what we're doing. Because they will come after you when you're asleep and when you're awake. They will try and get to you to stop us. Sadie said to me the other night, Jessica's in the light now. We need to keep her in the light. So that's why you're here telling me?" Jessica said. "That's one reason. I was hoping you would either be scared enough or sensible enough to keep as far away from this as you can. The world needs you, Jessica. And not to be an asshole, but we don't need you. Not for this. We need you right where you are." She hugged him. You're all going to die, aren't you?" she said, unable to look at him. He squeezed her tight and rubbed her back. "Probably not," he lied. "Not everyone," he lied a little less. "But," he pushed her to arm's length and held her gaze. "But, if we do, there needs to be someone left to understand what happened. There needs to be someone left to tell the tale. Don't go. Please. Send some of those awful people Lila hires. Most of them are..." Jack hugged her again, and she started to cry. I already lost my family once, Jack. I can't lose it again." "It has to be us, Jessica. It has to be me. I need to do it for Becky. I need to do it for you and other people like you. Besides," he said with a fake smile, "who else ever had the chance to crawl inside the devil's head and blow it up?" She turned her back to him. Sadness turned angry. "You want me to call Manny? See if he can bring over some pizzas?" Jack asked softly. "Promise me," she answered. "Promise me you will do whatever you can to come back." "I promise. I don't want to die. Not anymore." She nodded and wiped her cheek. "Okay. I believe you. And yes, pizza sounds really good right now." Thank you for listening to another episode of A Scary Home Companion. Find the show on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and we've got a fun little Reddit page. If you enjoy the show but have never left a review for it, please do so. Online reviews boost the visibility of A Scary Home Companion. It's a great free way to help us grow. A better way to help us grow is with money, as in, join the Patreon. A few bucks a month gets you tons of extras, analysis videos, and best of all, the bonus episodes. The latest exclusive bonus episode dropped yesterday, before this one was even released. join the cool cats, including our latest supporter, Jason Funderburk, on Patreon. Guest voices this time around, from Chris Kaufman, Kelly Kaufman, Dan Joplin, Buck Rogers, and the lovely and talented Jamie Lee Hensley. Music provided by Beat Mechanic with Thumper and Lisa Hammer with Cold Dread, Deep Note, Ethereal Dread, Graveyard Picnic, High Pitch, and Night Terror. All of these tunes and thousands more are available at freemusicarchive.org.